Section 1. Listening. This section of the test has three parts. You will hear four recordings, which you will listen to twice. While listening, answer the questions in the appropriate part of the test. Follow the instructions. When answering questions in the first and second parts, use the answer sheet labelled with a cross. When answering questions in the third part, use the answer sheet labelled with a pen. Now prepare the answer sheet labelled with a cross. Part 1. In this part, you will hear two different extracts. In the first extract, you will hear an interview with Sophie Kinsella, a popular British writer. In the second extract, you will hear an interview with Dr. Richard Bartell, a neurosurgeon. For the following statements 1 to 10, choose the correct answer A, B, C or D. There is always only one correct answer. Mark your answers on the answer sheet labelled with a cross. Now you have 2 minutes to read the tasks. Now listen to part 1. Extract 1. An interview with Sophie Kinsella. The brilliant Sophie Kinsella has been invited to our radio programme for a chat about her books. Sophie first hit the UK bestseller lists in September 2000 with her first novel in the Shopaholic series. Since then, she has sold over 45 million copies of her books, including her standalone novels, in more than 60 countries. Can You Keep a Secret is going to be a film. You've been to New York. How's filming going?
Yeah, it's going really well, thank you. So I saw some scenes being filmed, I met cast members, and I met with the producers and the screenwriter, which for me is very important. He's very concerned to keep it true to the book as much as possible, which is nice. There isn't room for everything in a film that you have in a book, so there are some scenes from the book which won't be in the film, which is always going to be the way. But when I was there, the cast and the scenes that I saw being filmed were really funny. So I came away feeling extremely happy, like this is going to be great.
What inspires you to write?
I'm slightly addicted to story. I just love telling stories. I like creating comedy, and once I have an idea for a story or for a comedic scene, I get very impatient, like I want to see it on the page. That's what drives me through writing a book, because I want to see how it turns out, or I can't wait for this plot twist, and it really drives me along.
What's your favourite book to read?
Oh, do you mean as relaxation? The truth is, when I want to relax, I read Agatha Christie, because it's very, very different from what I'm doing. I do read my friends and contemporary authors, but when you read something that is too like what you do, it's slightly professional, and you're like, oh, that's an interesting choice, or oh, what would I do? I'm never going to write an Agatha Christie book, so I'm able to just enjoy them, and I always forget who did it, which is very handy, so I can reread them.
What's your favorite place that you've ever been to?
My favorite place is probably my own bed, but I'm sensing that's not the answer that you want. In terms of rememberable and spectacular, it is Utah in the States. You know, you visit a lot of places and you think, this is a bit like here or that's a bit like that. Utah was unlike anything. It was a bit like the moon. It was such a spectacularly different landscape, and I really thought, I know I'm somewhere different now. So that's what always stayed with me.
On the topic of book covers, do you have a favorite book cover of yours?
I have quite a few, actually. I think one of my favorites is the first ever Shopaholic cover in the American edition. The reason I loved it was that it was very plain white on the front with just a price tag, and then you open it up and you saw inside Becky's wardrobe. It was chaotic, shoes and clothes and bags, and I loved that because it was so witty. You picked up a very plain looking book wondering, oh, what is this? And pow! So that was fun, and it was quite something.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was nice to chat.
Extract 2. An interview with Dr. Richard Bartell. Dr. Richard Bartell is an American neurosurgeon who has earned an outstanding reputation. Dr. Bartell is certified by the American Board of Neurological Surgery and is a fellow of the American Association of Neurological Surgeons. Dr. Bartell, how would you describe neurosurgery?
Neurosurgery is a specialty that involves the diagnosis and treatment of conditions affecting the brain, spinal cord, peripheral nerves, and their supporting and surrounding structures.
What does your work as a neurosurgeon involve?
3 days a week, I operate on the brain, the spine, or peripheral nerves. 2 days a week, I'm in the office seeing patients. I also teach medical students, and I give lectures to residents.
What is most challenging about what you do?
Brain microsurgery done under the microscope for aneurysms or certain deep tumors. The use of computers for a lot of surgery is standard now, so I think using a computer and a microscope for brain surgery are the most challenging aspects of the job.
What advice would you offer someone considering this career?
Well, the entry into medical school is pretty much now the same as it was 20 years ago. And then, once you get into medical school, you can gradually decide on any medical or surgical specialty. And you rotate through the different specialties, and you see what you like or which professor inspires you. But you need to work hard because when you go into practice, a normal workday is 10 to 12 hours a day. And there's always some night and weekend call. I have 4 partners, so I'm on call every 5th night and every 5th weekend. Which doesn't mean I operate at all those times. It means I must handle phone calls and emergencies.
What is a common misconception people have about what you do?
That you have to be really smart to be a brain surgeon. I know a lot of people who are not smart, who are just hard workers and got through their residency. I think it's something that takes a lot of years to learn, and it takes a lot of studying, and you must keep up with your field, you know, read 2 or 3 journals a month, take your courses, go to the meetings, and go to continuing medical education things. I mean, I know a lot of really smart neurosurgeons, but I also know a lot of neurosurgeons who are not really smart. I mean, they're not geniuses.
What are your goals for the future?
I'd like to, at some point, stop operating and just teach residents full-time. Besides teaching, I'd like to be able to do some laboratory research, which is hard to do unless you're doing it full-time. I did laboratory research for 1.5 years during my residency, and if you're doing it full-time, you can do it. But to do research in a laboratory when you're practicing neurosurgery is essentially impossible.
What else would you like people to know about what you do?
I would recommend neurosurgery. Nationally, there's a big shortage of neurosurgeons now, and there will continue to be a shortage of neurosurgeons for at least the next 20 years. The number of training programs has not increased in the last 15 years, and more neurosurgeons are retiring because it's a stressful profession. So, you have 98 residency programs graduating 136 residents a year, and there are about 150 neurosurgeons leaving practice each year because of health or retirement. So the number of neurosurgeons now is the same as the number of neurosurgeons in 1991, yet the population of the United States has grown by a third since 1990.
Now listen again. Extract 1. An interview with Sophie Kinsella. The brilliant Sophie Kinsella has been invited to our radio program for a chat about her books. Sophie first hit the UK bestseller lists in September 2000 with her first novel in the Shopaholic series. Since then, she has sold over 45 million copies of her books, including her standalone novels, in more than 60 countries. Can You Keep a Secret is going to be a film. You've been to New York. How's filming going?
Yeah, it's going really well, thank you. So I saw some scenes being filmed, I met cast members, and I met with the producers and the screenwriter, which for me is very important. He's very concerned to keep it true to the book as much as possible, which is nice. There isn't room for everything in a film that you have in a book, so there are some scenes from the book which won't be in the film, which is always going to be the way. But when I was there, the cast and the scenes that I saw being filmed were really funny. So I came away feeling extremely happy, like this is going to be great.
What inspires you to write?
I'm slightly addicted to story. I just love telling stories. I like creating comedy, and once I have an idea for a story or for a comedic scene, I get very impatient, like I want to see it on the page. That's what drives me through writing a book, because I want to see how it turns out, or I can't wait for this plot twist, and it really drives me along.
What's your favorite book to read?
Oh, do you mean as relaxation? The truth is, when I want to relax, I read Agatha Christie, because it's very, very different for what I'm doing. I do read my friends and contemporary authors, but when you read something that is too like what you do, it's slightly professional, and you're like, oh, that's an interesting choice, or oh, what would I do? I'm never going to write an Agatha Christie book, so I'm able to just enjoy them, and I always forget who did it, which is very handy, so I can reread them.
What's your favorite place that you've ever been to?
My favorite place is probably my own bed, but I'm sensing that's not the answer that you want. In terms of rememberable and spectacular, it is Utah in the States. You know, you visit a lot of places and you think, this is a bit like here or that's a bit like that. Utah was unlike anything. It was a bit like the moon. It was such a spectacularly different landscape, and I really thought, I know I'm somewhere different now. So that's what always stayed with me.
On the topic of book covers, do you have a favorite book cover of yours?
I have quite a few, actually. I think one of my favorites is the first ever Shopaholic cover in the American edition. The reason I loved it was that it was very plain white on the front with just a price tag, and then you open it up and you saw inside Becky's wardrobe. It was chaotic, shoes and clothes and bags, and I loved that because it was so witty. You picked up a very plain looking book wondering, oh, what is this? And pow! So that was fun, and it was quite something.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was nice to chat.
Extract 2. An interview with Dr. Richard Bartell. Dr. Richard Bartell is an American neurosurgeon who has earned an outstanding reputation. Dr. Bartell is certified by the American Board of Neurological Surgery and is a fellow of the American Association of Neurological Surgeons. Dr. Bartell, how would you describe neurosurgery?
Neurosurgery is a specialty that involves the diagnosis and treatment of conditions affecting the brain, spinal cord, peripheral nerves, and their supporting and surrounding structures.
What does your work as a neurosurgeon involve?
3 days a week I operate on the brain, the spine, or peripheral nerves. 2 days a week I'm in the office seeing patients. I also teach medical students and I give lectures to residents.
What is most challenging about what you do?
Brain microsurgery done under the microscope for aneurysms or certain deep tumors. The use of computers for a lot of surgery is standard now, so I think using a computer and a microscope for brain surgery are the most challenging aspects of the job.
What advice would you offer someone considering this career?
Well, the entry into medical school is pretty much now the same as it was 20 years ago. And then, once you get into medical school, you can gradually decide on any medical or surgical specialty. And you rotate through the different specialties and you see what you like or which professor inspires you. But you need to work hard because when you go into practice, a normal workday is 10 to 12 hours a day. And there's always some night and weekend call. I have four partners, so I'm on call every fifth night and every fifth weekend. Which doesn't mean I operate at all those times. It means I must handle phone calls and emergencies.
What is a common misconception people have about what you do?
That you have to be really smart to be a brain surgeon. I know a lot of people who are not smart, who are just hard workers and got through their residency. I think it's something that takes a lot of years to learn, and it takes a lot of studying, and you must keep up with your field, you know, read two or three journals a month, take your courses, go to the meetings, and go to continuing medical education things. I mean, I know a lot of really smart neurosurgeons, but I also know a lot of neurosurgeons who are not really smart. I mean, they're not geniuses.
What are your goals for the future?
I'd like to, at some point, stop operating and just teach residents full-time. Besides teaching, I'd like to be able to do some laboratory research, which is hard to do unless you're doing it full-time. I did laboratory research for a year and a half during my residency, and if you're doing it full-time, you can do it. But to do research in a laboratory when you're practicing neurosurgery is essentially impossible.
What else would you like people to know about what you do?
I would recommend neurosurgery. Nationally, there's a big shortage of neurosurgeons now, and there will continue to be a shortage of neurosurgeons for at least the next 20 years. The number of training programs has not increased in the last 15 years, and more neurosurgeons are retiring because it's a stressful profession. So, you have 98 residency programs graduating 136 residents a year, and there are about 150 neurosurgeons leaving practice each year because of health or retirement. So the number of neurosurgeons now is the same as the number of neurosurgeons in 1991, yet the population of the United States has grown by a third since 1990.
Now you have 30 more seconds to complete the tasks. Part 2. In this part, you will hear a radio program in which an expert explains how to make a good presentation. The expert will mention five ideas and five practical ways how to do it. There are two blocks of five matching questions. You will have to match all 10 questions while you are listening to this recording. Read the questions carefully before you listen. For questions 11 to 15, choose from the first list marked A to H, the main idea which is being described. For questions 16 to 20, choose from the second list marked A to H, the practical way how to do it. Be careful, there are three extra possibilities which you do not need to use. There is always only one correct answer. Mark your answers on the answer sheet labeled with a cross. Now you have 2 minutes to read the tasks. Now listen to part two.
In our radio program, we've gathered the best advice from experts like Tony Robbins, Steve Jobs, and Guy Kawasaki on how to make a good presentation great, along with knowledge and practical tips on both designing and delivering a presentation. Let's hear five ideas, followed by five sets of practical tips. Idea number one. When it comes to what you have to say, break it down into three simple sections. Your presentation needs an introduction, body, and conclusion. So how to prepare them? Your introduction needs to briefly sum up what you're going to talk about. The body of your presentation is where you hit them with the facts, quotes, and evidence. The conclusion is where you loop back to your original statement. Finally, no more than 10 slides in total. In this way, you'll give the audience a chance to digest the on-screen messages in line with your talk. Idea number two. Just like a pair of well-worn shoes, a good presentation often needs a few rounds of dusting before it's shiny and sparkly. Let's be more specific now. Don't be afraid to start messy. Arrange your ideas side by side and discover new connections that you didn't see before. Edit ruthlessly. At first, you might have a huge amount of information. That's okay. Keep editing and cutting down on words. Get a trusted mentor or colleague to check your work. If you don't know anyone who can help, an online writing assistant like Grammarly can help you. Idea number three. How you start your presentation is extremely important. Audiences usually make up their minds about someone in the first 7 seconds, so make those first moments count. How to do it practically? Be different. You're doing a presentation about saving tree frogs in Costa Rica. You open with an amusing story about one that escaped to the UK on a bunch of bananas. A story like this is unexpected for your audience, so they'll take notice. Ask a question. Rhetorical questions are a great way to frame a topic and introduce ideas. Tailor it to your audience. The more you know about your audience, the better. Insert a relevant metaphor or popular cultural reference. Idea number four. Oscar Wilde said, "Be yourself, everyone else is already taken." A lack of authenticity will be spotted a mile away. Whatever you're saying, speak from the heart and don't try to impress. How to do it practically? Use humor. Humor can be great for giving a presentation. Telling a humorous story can break down any barriers and make your message more memorable. Don't be afraid to mess up. Relax. Even the best speakers mess up or have bad luck. Open up. This means speaking your truth and daring to feel a little uncomfortable as you share a meaningful story. It will connect your audience to you like never before. Idea number five. With all the preparation you're doing on the content and design of your presentation, it can be easy to overlook other variables that are within your control for a stress-free delivery. So how to achieve a nice flow of your presentation? Have a practice run-through. There's nothing like reading it out loud to ensure your message makes sense before you deliver it. Use a remote. A clicker or remote will help you face the audience and not have to keep turning back to your laptop. Use a timer. Put your phone on airplane mode and set the stopwatch just as you begin speaking.
Now listen again.
In our radio program, we've gathered the best advice from experts like Tony Robbins, Steve Jobs, and Guy Kawasaki on how to make a good presentation great, along with knowledge and practical tips on both designing and delivering a presentation. Let's hear five ideas, followed by five sets of practical tips. Idea number one. When it comes to what you have to say, break it down into three simple sections. Your presentation needs an introduction, body, and conclusion. So how to prepare them? Your introduction needs to briefly sum up what you're going to talk about. The body of your presentation is where you hit them with the facts, quotes, and evidence. The conclusion is where you loop back to your original statement. Finally, no more than 10 slides in total. In this way, you'll give the audience a chance to digest the on-screen messages in line with your talk. Idea number two. Just like a pair of well-worn shoes, a good presentation often needs a few rounds of dusting before it's shiny and sparkly. Let's be more specific now. Don't be afraid to start messy. Arrange your ideas side by side and discover new connections that you didn't see before. Edit ruthlessly. At first, you might have a huge amount of information. That's okay. Keep editing and cutting down on words. Get a trusted mentor or colleague to check your work. If you don't know anyone who can help, an online writing assistant like Grammarly can help you. Idea number 3. How you start your presentation is extremely important. Audiences usually make up their minds about someone in the first 7 seconds, so make those first moments count. How to do it practically? Be different. You're doing a presentation about saving tree frogs in Costa Rica. You open with an amusing story about one that escaped to the UK on a bunch of bananas. A story like this is unexpected for your audience, so they'll take notice. Ask a question. Rhetorical questions are a great way to frame a topic and introduce ideas. Tailor it to your audience. The more you know about your audience, the better. Insert a relevant metaphor or popular cultural reference. Idea number 4. Oscar Wilde said, "Be yourself, everyone else is already taken." A lack of authenticity will be spotted a mile away. Whatever you're saying, speak from the heart and don't try to impress. How to do it practically? Use humor. Humor can be great for giving a presentation. Telling a humorous story can break down any barriers and make your message more memorable. Don't be afraid to mess up. Relax. Even the best speakers mess up or have bad luck. Open up. This means speaking your truth and daring to feel a little uncomfortable as you share a meaningful story. It will connect your audience to you like never before. Idea number 5. With all the preparation you're doing on the content and design of your presentation, it can be easy to overlook other variables that are within your control for a stress-free delivery. So how to achieve a nice flow of your presentation? Have a practice run-through. There's nothing like reading it out loud to ensure your message makes sense before you deliver it. Use a remote. A clicker or remote will help you face the audience and not have to keep turning back to your laptop. Use a timer. Put your phone on airplane mode and set the stopwatch just as you begin speaking.
Now you have 30 more seconds to complete the tasks. Now look at part 3. For part 3, you will need the answer sheet labelled with a pen. Please find and prepare it. Part 3. You will hear a radio programme in which Stephanie Boyce, a lawyer solicitor and president of the Law Society, expresses her determination to change the legal profession. Complete the sentences 21 to 30, which summarise the information from the text. Use from one word to three words in your answers. The number of words is indicated in brackets. Write your answers on the answer sheet labelled with a pen. Now you have 2 minutes to read the sentences. Now listen to part three.
In our radio program, we'll meet Stephanie Boyce, president of the Law Society, who is determined to change the legal profession and make a difference. Stephanie will talk about her professional path, and we are pleased that she is our guest today.
My dream of joining the legal profession began many years ago, growing up in a Caribbean household in Aylesbury, Buckinghamshire, which in the 1970s was a small, sleepy market town with little diversity compared with today. I could see the way the law touched every part of our lives, both domestically and globally. I could see people struggling to exercise their rights, and this is what initially inspired me to become a solicitor or a lawyer. Legal rights mean absolutely nothing if you don't know what those rights are or even when those rights are being taken away. The sense of injustice seemed even more apparent when I moved to the U.S. with my family as a teenager. I was very aware of the color of my skin and how Black people were treated differently. I was overwhelmed by the poverty and the inability to access justice because of low socioeconomic position and race. Aged 19, I graduated from high school and returned to the UK, still set on a career in law. It was not straightforward, as my U.S. qualifications weren't recognized, and it took me another 2 years of part-time study while supporting myself with jobs in the post office and British Rail before I finally got a place to study law at London Guildhall University. In 2002, I qualified as a solicitor. Despite my age, then 30, and despite my low socioeconomic background, I had made it, an achievement that still fills me with pride to this day. It took me a while to get my first job, and I was made redundant twice in as many years. So, tired by that, I decided to take in-house governance roles, including the pensions regulator and some others. In March 2021, I became the first person of color to be elected as president in the almost 200-year history of the Law Society of England and Wales, the organization that governs solicitors. It took 4 attempts for me to achieve this position, and I was so determined that I would have kept going if it hadn't happened then. When I took office, I was determined to leave the legal profession more diverse and inclusive than I entered. More must be done to remove barriers, open doors, and confront unacceptable behaviors that do not allow everyone the opportunity to succeed and make the most of their talents. This year marks 35 years since Black History Month began in the UK. The Black Lives Matter movement has dominated the news over the past few years. When it comes to the legal sector, it's fundamental that the profession should reflect the society it serves. By welcoming diverse voices and experiences, our clients can speak with solicitors who share similar experience and background to them. Our Race for Inclusion report found that 42% of white men who became partners had stayed in the same sector and firm, but only 20% of Black, Asian, and minority ethnic solicitors had been promoted by their existing employer. People go to solicitors for support and advice during significant events in their lives, family breakdown, a house purchase, estate planning, or the death or injury of a loved one. If we can improve accepting difference and inclusion in the legal profession, we can advise our clients much better when they deal with these life events.
Now listen again.
In our radio program, we'll meet Stephanie Boyce, president of the Law Society, who is determined to change the legal profession and make a difference. Stephanie will talk about her professional path, and we are pleased that she is our guest today.
My dream of joining the legal profession began many years ago, growing up in a Caribbean household in Aylesbury, Buckinghamshire, which in the 1970s was a small, sleepy market town with little diversity compared with today. I could see the way the law touched every part of our lives, both domestically and globally. I could see people struggling to exercise their rights, and this is what initially inspired me to become a solicitor or a lawyer. Legal rights mean absolutely nothing if you don't know what those rights are or even when those rights are being taken away. The sense of injustice seemed even more apparent when I moved to the U.S. with my family as a teenager. I was very aware of the color of my skin and how Black people were treated differently. I was overwhelmed by the poverty and the inability to access justice because of low socioeconomic position and race. Aged 19, I graduated from high school and returned to the UK, still set on a career in law. It was not straightforward, as my US qualifications weren't recognized, and it took me another 2 years of part-time study while supporting myself with jobs in the post office and British Rail before I finally got a place to study law at London Guildhall University. In 2002, I qualified as a solicitor. Despite my age, then 30, and despite my low socioeconomic background, I had made it, an achievement that still fills me with pride to this day. It took me a while to get my first job, and I was made redundant twice in as many years. So, tired by that, I decided to take in-house governance roles, including the pensions regulator and some others. In March 2021, I became the first person of color to be elected as president in the almost 200-year history of the Law Society of England and Wales, the organization that governs solicitors. It took 4 attempts for me to achieve this position, and I was so determined that I would have kept going if it hadn't happened then. When I took office, I was determined to leave the legal profession more diverse and inclusive than I entered. More must be done to remove barriers, open doors, and confront unacceptable behaviors that do not allow everyone the opportunity to succeed and make the most of their talents. This year marks 35 years since Black History Month began in the UK. The Black Lives Matter movement has dominated the news over the past few years. When it comes to the legal sector, it's fundamental that the profession should reflect the society it serves. By welcoming diverse voices and experiences, our clients can speak with solicitors who share similar experience and background to them. Our Race for Inclusion report found that 42% of white men who became partners had stayed in the same sector and firm, but only 20% of Black, Asian, and minority ethnic solicitors had been promoted by their existing employer. People go to solicitors for support and advice during significant events in their lives, family breakdown, a house purchase, estate planning, or the death or injury of a loved one. If we can improve accepting difference and inclusion in the legal profession, we can advise our clients much better when they deal with these life events.
Now you have 30 more seconds to complete the tasks. The listening section is now over. Please stop working on this section. Now go on to the next sections of the test.